The captain didn't get his wish. At the end of the day, the frogheads still hadn't reached their destination, forcing Aphrodite to seek another island where it could anchor for the night. Again, the frogheads found a place to rest on its mossy, vine-covered banks. As darkness fell on the ocean, Angelo opened a locker on the aft deck and pulled out a large net. Ronson thought at first that he intended to go trawling, but instead Angelo told him and Mikhail to rig the net above the boat, from the wheelhouse roof to poles erected at the stern, until the deck was completely covered. Angelo then switched off the deck lamps, and once the three of them went below, he closed the curtains in the cabin portholes. They'd barely finished dinner when Ronson discovered the reason why the captain had taken such precautions. From somewhere outside came the sound of wings flapping, punctuated by high-pitched shrieks. Mikhail explained that they belonged to one of Venus's few avian species, nightshrikes, nocturnal raptors, not much larger than the pelicans they vaguely resembled, but dangerous nonetheless. The shrikes hunted in flocks, seeking prey near the islands where they nested. They had little fear of humans and had been known to gang up on unwary sailors who ventured out on deck after dark. The nets would keep them away, and if that didn't work, a taser shot was sufficient to drive them off. Still, the best defense was to remain inside until daybreak. Through the night, long after the three of them had crawled into their bunks, Ronson heard the shrikes prowling around the boat. Distant thunder and lightning flashes glimpsed around the edges of the porthole curtains told of an approaching storm. It came in around midnight, and although it only rocked the boat a bit and threw rain against the portholes, it kept Ronson awake for a while. He lay in his bunk, taser beneath his pillow, listening to the shrikes and the storm. Venus was a dangerous world. Yet the morning was calm. The rain had slackened to a mild drizzle, the sun a hot splotch half seen through the clouds. The frogheads were croaking impatiently beside the boat when Ronson and the others emerged from the cabin. Mikhail gave chocolate bars to two of the aborigines. As before, their leader refused to accept any, while Angelo and Ronson took down the net and hoisted the anchor. Then the captain started the engine, and Aphrodite set out again, the frogheads once more taking the lead. The floating isles had become bigger and less far apart by then, and for the first time, Ronson saw forests on the larger ones. Slick bark trees looked like palmettos, but grew in dense jungle clusters, their broad trunks strangled by vines, their broad, serrated leaves casting shadows across the surrounding water. Around mid-morning, Aphrodite came within sight of a larger vessel going the other way, a lumber ship the size of a small freighter, its deck loaded with cut and trimmed tree trunks. The lumber ship blew its horn as it went by, but Angelo didn't respond to the hail. "A Yaz runner wouldn't do that," the captain explained. "Yaz runner?" Ronson asked. "You mean like someone who's out to purchase Yaz, uh-huh?" Angelo gave him a sidelong look. "That's what we're going to pretend to be once we get to this place. Because, believe me, there ain't no way they're gonna let us live if they don't think we're here to buy dope." Ronson was still coming to grips with this when the froghead suddenly turned to the right and started heading for a large island only a kilometer away. As Aphrodite approached the island, the three men spotted thin lines of smoke rising from its forest. Angelo handed a pair of binoculars to Ronson, and through them he saw a couple of boats about Aphrodite's size, tied up at a floating dock.
"It's a Yaz camp, all right,"
Angelo said, then he looked off to the side.
"Hey, what the hell are they doing?"
Ronson followed his gaze. The three frogheads had suddenly turned and were swimming back toward the boat.
"I think they want to talk," Mikhail said.
Angelo throttled down the engines.
"So talk to him,"
he muttered with an annoyed shrug. As the boat came to idle, the Russian walked back to the stern. By then, the frogheads were dog paddling along the starboard side, their faces visible above the water. The leader warbled something to Mikhail. He listened for a few moments, then turned to Ronson.
She says this is the place where we will find the men we are looking for, Mikhail said, but they refuse to go any farther. They will remain here until they see us leave. Then they will follow us.
Ronson was puzzled as to why the waterfolk wouldn't escort them the rest of the way to the island, but he wasn't about to argue. As the boat began moving again, he went below, where he found the taser he'd left beneath his bunk pillow. He had just slid its holster on his belt, though, when Mikhail followed him into the cabin.
Leave that behind, the Russian said. If the Yaz croppers see you wearing it, they'll think we mean trouble.
Ronson stared at him. Then how the hell am I supposed to rescue the kid? Mad Mikhail hesitated.
We will think of something, he said at last. Let me do the talking, yes?
Again, Ronson didn't have a choice. As the boat came closer to the island, though, he came out on deck with the taser beneath the nylon rain jacket he'd put on. When no one was looking, he carefully hid the weapon behind the net locker, where it couldn't be seen, it could be easily reached. Men on the island had seen Aphrodite coming. Two Yaz croppers were waiting on the dock as the boat glided up beside it. They grabbed the lines Mikhail and Ronson tossed to them, then pulled the fishing boat alongside their own craft. Then a thick-set man with gray, brush-cut hair rested a foot on Aphrodite's gunwale, arms folded across his bare chest.
Привет, he said, gruff yet not entirely hostile. Как вас зовут?
Mikhail Kronov,
Mad Mikhail replied.
Вы говорите по-английски?
The other Russian looked over at his companion, a younger man with a shaved head and a goatee beard.
I do, mate,
he replied, an Australian accent to his voice.
So who the hell are you, eh?
He is Gospodin Ronson, an American friend.
Mikhail barely glanced at Ronson.
Thank you for speaking English. His Russian is very bad.
The Aussie laughed, but the Russian remained silent, apparently not understanding a word they were saying.
We are here to do some business, yes?
What sort of business?
I think you know what kind.
A smile and a sly wink.
May we speak to your leader? Someone we can, how do you say? Negotiate, yes?
Vidyatska is cornea, Ronson said. Mikhail gave him a sharp look, but he saw no need to dance around the subject. There was only one reason why a boat would be all the way out here. I'm looking to buy Yaz. The Aussie looked to the older man and spoke to him in his own language. The Russian cropper studied Ronson and Mikhail for a few moments, dark eyes sizing them up. Then he slowly nodded, and the Aussie turned to the visitors.
Sure, come on, this way.
Ronson glanced back at the wheelhouse. Angelo was standing at the door. He shook his head, silently telling Ronson that he was going to stay behind. Ronson nodded, then followed Mikhail off the boat. With the two croppers leading the way, they walked onto the island. The ground was soft and spongy. Until he reached the crude walkway of wooden boards laid down by the croppers, Ronson's shoes sank a bit with each step he took, making squishy sounds. The forest closed in around them as he and Mikhail were led away from the dock until they couldn't see Aphrodite anymore, and he fought an impulse to hold his breath against a pungent reek that permeated the humid, chlorophyll-laden air. It got stronger the farther they walked, and at first he thought it came from the jungle around them. But then they reached the middle of the island, and he saw what was causing it. A clearing had been hacked out amid the trees and tangled underbrush, and it was here that the croppers had set up camp. Wooden shacks and canvas tents surrounded an open area. Nets were suspended from tall poles erected around the periphery, doubtless to ward off night strikes, but probably also to provide camouflage from any aircraft that might pass overhead. The camp had the basic amenities, a cook tent, a cluster of satellite dishes, outhouses, and might just as well have belonged to a wilderness expedition, were it not for what was at its center. Vats made from discarded fuel drums had been set up above iron braziers. Brackish water slowly boiled over wood coals, emitting stinking fumes that made his eyes weep. The men and women stirring the vats wore bandanas around the lower parts of their faces, and Ronson wished he'd known enough to take the same precautions. Lumpy brown scum floated on top of the bubbling water. As he watched, one of the croppers dipped a large, long-handled spoon into a vat, carefully scooped out a dripping mass, and placed it on a tray, which was then carried to a wooden platform, set up beneath a tarp and laid out to dry.
Yes, Mikhail murmured, nodding toward the platform.
Yeah, here's where we make it.
The Aussie, his name was Graham, Ronson had learned during the trek through the forest, proudly pointed to the vats. The Russian, whose name was Boris, had left them as soon as they entered the camp.
We drop the roots in there, boil off the resin, scoop it out, cure it. That's how we get the good stuff.
His finger moved to an open-sided shed, where a couple of women were using a grocery scale to weigh bundles of Vidyatska itskornia, before wrapping them in paper and twine.
Each of those is half a kilo,
Graham went on, indicating a nearby shack where a large stack of bricks could be seen through the door.
From this island alone, we'd probably get, I'd say 500 kilos at least.
And then you move on, Ronson said.
Another island, another crop, another big pile of rubles.
Graham laughed, clapped him on the back.
Your pot farmers back in the States got nothing on us. They're stuck in one place, but we're a mobile operation.
Ronson only half listened to Graham as he searched the faces of the men and women around them, trying to spot David Henry. No one here looked like him, though, even allowing for the bandanas covering the faces of the men stirring the vats. Indeed, no one in the camp looked like they were being forced to do anything. Some smiled and joked as they worked, and there were no armed guards keeping them in line. If anyone here had been shanghaied, they didn't seem to be upset about it. Bulgakov might have been wrong, and the frogheads. Ronson felt annoyance growing in him. How could he have been so stupid as to trust those things? Masters of the world ocean, his soaked ass. Animals, really, despite what Mikhail claimed. No wonder he was called Mad Mikhail. Someone tapped him on the shoulder. Ronson looked around and saw that Boris had returned, and standing beside him, wearing a jungle hat and a sweat-stained Coldplay t-shirt, was David Henry.
Hello, David said, offering a handshake. I hear you'd like to buy some yaz.
It was only his brief experience working undercover for the NYPD Vice Squad that kept Ronson from showing the surprise he felt. In an instant, he realized why David Henry had disappeared without a trace. Perhaps he hadn't come to Venus intending to become a drug lord. Perhaps the opportunity presented itself only after he'd been here a while. Yet he wasn't a captive of these Yaz croppers. He was their boss.
That's what I'm looking to do, Ronson shook his hand. Nice little operation you've got here. I never knew how this stuff was made.
David grinned, shrugged nonchalantly.
Not many people do until they see it themselves. No harder than weed or even crack, for that matter. And out here it's a little easier to get away with.
He motioned to the net strung above them.
That's really just to keep out the birds. The law's just about given up trying to find us. I don't think they even give a shit anymore.
Ronson silently agreed. Bulgakov had just about told him as much.
Must be a hassle getting the roots, though, he said, trying to find something to talk about while he gave himself a chance to figure out how to play this.
He looked around the camp. I mean, it doesn't look like you're cutting down any trees. Well, I've got my own. David's voice trailed off. His gaze had fallen on Mikhail, who stood quietly nearby.
Hey, I know you, he exclaimed. You're...
He snapped his fingers a couple of times, trying to summon a memory. That guy, the one who hangs out on the docks at Venerograd and gets a frog he used to pose for pictures.
Mikhail Kronov.
Mikhail's eyes shifted nervously back and forth.
Yeah, mad Mikhail.
David was both surprised and happy to see him. I guess you don't remember me. We never talked or anything, but man, do I remember you. I owe you a lot, dude.
Mikhail stared at him. You do?
Uh-huh. David looked at Ronson again. You got him as your translator, right? I mean, he couldn't have known how to find us, so I guess the dude who's driving your boat must have done that. That's pretty much it, yeah. Ronson let David make his own assumptions. Mikhail hooked us up when I told him what I was looking for, so...
Cool.
David returned his attention to Mikhail.
Like I was saying, that trick you have, getting the froggies to come running for chocolate?
He waved an expansive hand around the camp. That's made all this possible. Come on, let me show you. Another boardwalk led away from the camp. It ended at a smaller clearing not far away, where two croppers stood around a hole. It appeared to have been cut straight down through the vines and moss that made up the floating island, forming a deep well. A wheelbarrow stood nearby. The two men watched the hole, as if waiting for something to emerge.
When I first came here, David explained as they approached the hole, croppers were using roots of slick bark trees cut down by the lumber operators, which is okay, except that by the time our people got to them, the roots were all dried out, and that meant the yaz they got from them had lost much of its potency. Everyone knew that fresh roots make better yaz, but since slick bark roots grow underwater, you'd have to use scuba gear and train divers to swim beneath the islands to get to them. And that's dangerous as hell. Something might eat you while you're down there. Then I had an idea.
Coming up, said one of the men watching the well. The water bubbled for a moment. Then a frog head came to the surface. Its silver eyes regarded the men standing around the well for a couple of seconds. They stepped back from the hole to give it room, and the aboriginal came the rest of the way up. A nylon bag was harnessed to its chest. Once the froghead was standing on dry ground, one of the men unfastened the harness, carried the bag over to the wheelbarrow, and upended it. A couple of wet, fibrous objects that looked like large knots fell into the wheelbarrow. Slick bark roots. The man who'd collected the bag from the froghead picked up a root, inspected it, then held it out for his boss to see. He said something in Russian. David frowned a little, but nodded anyway. The other cropper reached into his pocket, pulled out a Hershey bar, and held it out to the froghead. Surprisingly, the aborigine didn't immediately take it.
Wargo, wargo,
it croaked, looking down at the hole from which it had just emerged.
Croc-a-co-wak-wak.
Mikhail hissed, an angry sound that only Ronson heard. He didn't say anything, but from the corner of his eye, he could see that Mikhail's mouth was drawn into a tight line. Oh, come on, the man with the candy bar said. He was an American, a southerner judging by his accent. Take it and get back down there. When the froghead didn't accept the chocolate, he yanked a cattle prod from his belt. This or this, he said, holding up both the prod and the Hershey bar. Your choice. The froghead flinched at the sight of the cattle prod. Ronson realized then that this creature was different from the three water folk who'd escorted Aphrodite from Venerograd. Thinner, its head slumped forward and its eyes dulled. There were dark, bruise-like marks on its flanks that could only have been caused by electrical burns. He was looking at a slave.
Craw,
it said softly, then it reached for the Hershey bar. Yeah, crow this, you ugly mother. The cropper broke the bar in half and tossed the froghead the smaller part.
Now get back down there. The next time, make him bigger.
The froghead put the chocolate in its mouth, swallowed it slowly. Then, as if resigned to its fate, it turned and jumped feet first down the hole.
Pretty slick, Ronson said softly.
Mikhail remained quiet.
I kinda think so, David grinned, proud of himself. I mean, it's just regular, ordinary chocolate, but they're totally addicted to it, so all we have to do is find a few froggies and give them a couple bars, then don't give them any more until they learn to chew off slick bark roots and bring them to us.
Hell, I don't think they want anything else now but chocolate.
The man with the cattle prod started to take a bite from the other half of the bar, then stopped himself.
Running low, boss,
he added, his voice becoming worried. I don't think we've got but a few bars left.
Really?
David frowned. Well, we're going to have to do something about that next time we send someone to Venerograph for supplies.
We've got some on the boat, Ronson said.
Oh, yeah?
David looked at him again, his face brightening again.
How much?
Whole bag full. Couple of dozen bars at least.
Ronson was exaggerating. He knew that Mikhail had brought only a few. But an idea had occurred to him. Come on back to the boat, and I'll give them to you. We can work out a deal on the way. I got the cash there, too.
A smile stretched across David Henry's face. Sounds like a plan.
He turned to walk back toward the camp.
I like a man who comes prepared. Let's go.
Ronson followed him, consciously avoiding Mikhail's angry glare. Capturing David Henry was almost ridiculously easy. The kid was so confident that the Russian authorities would never catch him, he'd become trustful of anyone who offered to buy Yaz from him. He didn't even take any of his crew with him when he followed Ronson and Mikhail back to the dock. Ronson kept up the pretense on the way to the Aphrodite. He had to guess how much a runner might offer for 100 kilos of Yaz, but it appeared that he was close to the mark when he bid 500,000 rubles. David tried to talk him up to 600, and by the time they reached the boat, they'd settled on 550, plus the bag of chocolate bars, which David laughingly called a sweetener. He was still chuckling at his own joke when they stepped onto the boat. Ronson was smiling too, as he casually bent down beside the net locker and found the taser he'd hidden there. He straightened up, turned around, and fired it at David before he knew what was happening. The charged prongs hit him in the chest. The kid collapsed with little more than a grunt, and he was still twitching on the aft deck when Ronson and Mikhail hastily cast off the lines, and Angelo started up the engine. By the time David regained his senses, his wrists and ankles were bound, and he'd been deprived of the jackknife Ronson found in his pocket. He rolled over on the deck and glared at the detective.
What the fuck are you?
Your father hired me to come find you.
Ronson was sitting beneath the tarp, watching the island as it receded behind them.
If you're lucky, I'll be taking you home to him. But I know a certain cop who might have a say in that, so...
He shrugged.
Dude, you're so screwed. When my guys figure out what you've done, they'll come after you.
Ronson shook his head. Don't count on it. No one's following us.
I imagine that even if they put two and two together, they're not going to risk everything trying to rescue you. My guess is that they'll pack up and move out as fast as they can, and someone will take over as the new boss.
He glanced at David, gave him a knowing smile. Hate to break it to you, kid, but with guys like that, you're expendable. And easily replaced. David Henry glowered, but didn't reply. He must have realized the truth of what Ronson was saying. Ronson cracked open a beer he'd found in the galley.
So, how'd you fall into all this, anyway? Did you come here looking to get into the Yaz business? Or was it just something you stumbled into and...
Slow down.
Mikhail was standing at the bow, searching the waters ahead.
Stop. The waterfall could just ahead.
Oh, for God's sake.
Angelo was reluctant to stop for the frogheads who'd led them to the island, but he throttled down the engines and the boat coasted to a halt.
Make it quick, okay? I want to put distance between us and the croppers.
The three aborigines floated just beneath the surface, their protuberant eyes the only things visible. As the boat idled, its engine still throbbing, Mikhail leaned over the rail and called to them. He spoke for nearly a minute, but the frogheads didn't respond. When he was done, they silently submerged, vanishing as if they'd never been there. Angelo waited a few seconds to make sure he wouldn't run over them, then started up the boat again. What did you say to them? Ronson asked once Mikhail came back to the aft deck. Mikhail didn't reply at once. He stood over David Henry, hands clenched at his sides, regarding the kid with cold and murderous eyes. David tried to return his gaze, but quickly looked away.
I told them we found the men we were looking for,
Mikhail said at last, his voice low,
and thanked them for their help.
That's all? Ronson didn't believe him. Mikhail had spoken a long time for something as simple as that. Mikhail nodded, then went below, closing the cabin door behind him. Aphrodite continued westward, chasing the shrouded sun as it gradually dipped toward the horizon. It was beginning to slide into the ocean when Angelo called a stop for the night. There was no islands around, so he simply stopped the engines, allowing the boat to drift. With no nearby islands, there was little chance they'd attract the shrikes who haunted them. The captain left the nets in the locker, and since it was a mild evening, Mikhail suggested that they have dinner on the aft deck beneath the tarp. Time to relax a bit. All the same, Ronson took the precaution of scanning the ocean with the binoculars. Aside from a distant logging ship, they'd seen no other boats since escaping the Yaz camp. As he'd predicted, the croppers had apparently decided that pursuing the people who'd abducted their chief, their former chief, was more trouble than it was worth. And although he'd occasionally glimpsed waterfolk breaching the surface, they'd kept away from the boat. He couldn't tell whether they were the same ones they'd met before, but he doubted it. Their task was done. No reason for them to have anything further to do with the humans. He was wrong. Darkness had fallen when a froghead rose to surface just behind Aphrodite's stern. By then, the four men were seated in folding deck chairs beneath the awning. Ronson had removed the ropes around David's ankles, but left his wrists tied. He was eating canned stew from the paper plate Angelo had placed in his lap when Ronson happened to glance behind the boat and spotted a pair of eyes that reflected the light of the deck lamps like silver coins. Company, he said. Angelo turned around in his chair, followed his gaze.
Oh, hell,
he muttered, annoyed by the distraction.
What does it want?
He looked to Mikhail.
Give it a candy bar and tell it to go away. It's putting me off my food.
Mikhail had been quiet all afternoon, saying little to anyone. Now he put down his plate, pushed back his chair, and stood up. Instead of turning to the froghead, no, Ronson realized there wasn't just one pair of eyes, but two, and now three. He looked at David.
You remember when we were at your camp, and you were showing us how you got the water folk to bring you tree roots?
He asked.
You remember that one of them said something to you and your people?
David said nothing, and Mikhail went on.
I know you did not understand what it was saying, but I did. It said that it did not want any more chocolate, and then it begged you to let it go.
Yeah, well, the kid was watching the frogheads. They were coming closer to the boat. Ronson counted six pairs of eyes, and it seemed like more were coming.
That's really tough, but I don't think...
No, you don't think, do you?
Mikhail stepped away from the circle of chairs, out from under the tarp.
And now, you pay the price.
A thump against the stern. Then a frog head reached over the side. With surprising speed and agility, it pulled itself aboard. Its feet had barely touched the deck when another one followed it, and then a third.
Hey, what are you...
Angelo was out of his chair, staring at the creatures. Tell these goddamn things to get off my boat!
They will be gone soon.
Mikhail was calm, hands at his sides.
They will leave as soon as they have taken what they want from us.
A faint smile.
And no, it isn't chocolate.
Mikhail, this has gone far enough. Ronson stood up, felt for the taser he'd clipped to his belt. His hand fell upon an empty holster. Sometime in the last half hour or so, it had disappeared. He remembered Mikhail's bumping against him just before they sat down for dinner and immediately knew what he'd done. Mikhail. Frogheads were coming over the starboard and port gunnels. Ronson could hear more coming over the bow. 8, 10, 12? He had no idea how many. Now it wasn't just their eyes that were reflecting the light, but also the teeth within their open mouths. Wet, sharp teeth.
Get him away from me!
The plate fell from David Henry's lap as he leaped to his feet. His eyes, when they swung toward Ronson, were wide and utterly terrified.
Get a gun or something and get them the fuck away from me!
Ronson looked at Mikhail. Frogheads were standing on either side of the Russian now, advancing toward the other three men beneath the tarp.
Don't do this, Mikhail. Don't let them do this.
Go below,
Mikhail replied.
You too, Captain. If you do not interfere, they will not.
All at once, the waterfolk attacked. Ronson saw little of what happened next. It was swift, it was violent, and by the time he and Angelo reached the cabin and threw themselves inside, it was over. Almost. The screams were still coming as the captain slammed the door shut, and they put their weight against it. The frogheads hadn't come for them, though. They'd come for David Henry. And for Mikhail, too. Both men put up a fight, but it didn't last but a few seconds. The boat rocked back and forth, and there were the sounds of a struggle from the other side of the door, a series of loud splashes, and then the night was quiet again. Ronson waited a minute or so, not just to make sure that the frogheads had left, but also to give his heart a chance to stop hammering against his chest. Then, with Angelo fearfully peering over his shoulder, he inched the door open and peered out. Overturned chairs, a ripped tarp, blood on the deck already mixing with puddles of seawater. No bodies. The two men stood on the aft deck, feeling the warm rain against their faces. In the far distance, lightning flashes briefly delineated the horizon, painting the clouds with shades of purple and silver. Silver, the color of the waterfolk's eyes. A soft rumble of thunder. A storm was approaching.
I really hate this fucking planet,
Angelo whispered.
Yeah, Ronson said. Me too.
Levi Tidhar. Here's a vivid pulp adventure of the old-fashioned kind, full of slam-bang action, that pits a hard-bitten spaceman against a vengeful god from a lost civilization in the depths of the steaming Venusian swamps. Levi Tidhar grew up on a kibbutz in Israel, has traveled widely in Africa and Asia, and has lived in London, the South Pacific island of Vanuatu, and Laos. He is the winner of the 2003 Clark Bradbury Prize, awarded by the European Space Agency, was the editor of Michael Marshall Smith, The Annotated Bibliography, and the anthologies A Dick and Jane Primer for Adults and The Apex Book of World SF. He is the author of the linked story collection Hebrew Punk, the novella chapbooks An Occupation of Angels, Gorel and the Pot-Bellied God, Cloud Permutations, Jesus and the Eightfold Path, and, with Nir Yaniv, the novel The Tel Aviv Dossier. A prolific short story writer, his stories have appeared in Interzone, Clark's World, Apex Magazine, Sci Fiction, Strange Horizons, Cheezine, Postscripts, Fantasy Magazine, Mnemonymous, Infinity Plus, Eon, The Book of Dark Wisdom, Fortean Bureau and elsewhere, and have been translated into 7 languages. His latest novels include The Bookman and its sequel, Camera Obscura, Osama, a novel, and most recently, The Great Game. Osama, a novel, won the World Fantasy Award as the year's best novel in 2012. His most recent books are novels, Martian Sands and The Violent Century. After a spell in Tel Aviv, he's currently living in England again.
The Drowned Celestial by Lavie Tidar. Read for you by Roy Dotrice. 1. Kalt was playing cards when trouble crawled in through the door in the shape of a dead man who didn't yet know he was dead. This was on old Venus, ancient and most decadent of planets. Make no mistake, as the blind poet said, man has conquered space before. Woman, too. Though in fairness, Kalt thought, what women had come to this planet in Ian's pass had not seemed to make it as far as Portsmouth. It was a dismal Earth outpost, stranded somewhere on a solid strip of land amidst Venusian swamps. Violet clouds capped it like a forest of mushrooms, and the thick green-leaved jungle sprouted at the edges of the swamps on all sides, enclosing the port in its relentless grip. The Earthmen called the place Portsmouth. What the Venusians called it, Kalt didn't know. Kalt was playing a mixed Martian wildcard stud. He was in for all he was worth, which admittedly, at that precise moment, wasn't a hell of a lot. Kalt was out of cash and out of luck, and he needed a boost of both if he were ever to get off this wretched planet. Neither seemed likely to materialize. In the corner, old Ishmael, the blind musician, brought his instrument to his lips and began to haltingly play. It was a dream flute, and as he blew gently into its mouthpiece, ghosts rose into existence around the bar. Kalt's breath was caught in his throat, for they were Venusian dancers, from some long-vanished Atlantean temple, perhaps. Bold and free with their long, flowing black hair, their eyes in which ships sailed in the infinity of space. Slowly they grew solidity and shape, gliding in a dance through the bar, amidst the tables and unoccupied chairs, and the eyes of all men in that place turned to them, in fascinated enchantment, even Kalt's. All but the musicians' blind eyes. It was hot. The humidity wore you down after a while. The other men sweated, though Kalt kept his cool. Outside the windows of the Medusa's head, the cloud cover stretched from horizon to horizon, covering the sky in an impenetrable dome. It was the same weather that on Earth heralds the coming of a hurricane. From time to time, a distant explosion could be heard as one of the ships took off into the sky. Glancing out of the window, Kalt was startled anew, each time by a flash of silver as a rocket rose, disappearing beyond the clouds. He downed his glass of local archaea, squinted at his cards, and waited for his luck to change, for better or for worse. There was a rumble in the distance, and the other players looked up. Colt kept his eyes on the table and his free hand on the butt of his gun. He was playing a four-hander. The others were two short, scaly Venusians and an Earthman who called himself Carter. The sound, as of a distant explosion, sounded again, followed a moment later by a rumble that, this time, shook the ground. "That ain't no sound of no rocket ship," the other Earthman, Carter, said. The two Venusians exchanged uneasy glances, but kept their own counsel. "All in," Colt said, and pushed what remained of his money, a bag full of gold Martian ingots, into the pot. For a moment there was a silence. "I'm out," one of the Venusians said, and the Earthman immediately followed suit. Colt found himself staring into the other Venusian's eyes. The Venusian's mouth curled in a smile Colt did not like. "Well?" he demanded. Slowly the Venusian laid down his cards. Colt stared at the Venusian's cards and felt his heart sink. He had lost. The Venusian had the Queen of Despair, the Jack of Despair, and a Ten of the same. On the table, the community cards were the Seven of Love, the Two of Surrendered Bliss, the Nine of Love, and the Shamblo, the wild card. The Venusian had a royal straight. Colt had nothing. Nothing but a gun. "Don't," the Venusian said. There was an unmistakable sound of a weapon being charged. At that moment, a third explosion erupted outside. This time, it was almost directly overhead. The aftershock rocked the foundations of the bar and toppled the unoccupied chairs. It smashed glasses to the floor and made the cards fly into the air. Colt's hand closed on his bag of ingots and made it disappear. Already he was rising, the gun in front of him, aimed at the door. The blind musician put his dream flute down. The dancing girls flickered, then faded away, and Colt felt a momentary sense of loss. "What?" the Earthman Carter began to say. The door to the bar blew open inward, and a man came crawling into the room. He lunged forward in one desperate, terrifying, last desire to live, and fell by Colt's feet. He was badly hurt. "Get down!" A ray gun blast followed the man through the open door, and the Earthman, Carter, fell down, screaming, as his face melted beyond recognition. Not taking his eyes off the door, Colt reached across the table and swept the man's remaining money into a pouch by his side. The Earthman would not now need it, but Colt did. Mercifully, the other man's screams shortly died, and with them the man himself. There were now three against the unknown menace, the two Venusians and Colt. The blind musician had disappeared, taking his dreams with him. "Rogue," one of the two Venusians, the one who had folded early, said. Looking wildly in all directions, he ran to the door and outside. Colt could hear him shouting, but whether he was pleading or threatening or both, he could not tell. There was a fourth rumble of an explosion, shaking the walls and the floor, and Colt could hear the man scream outside, then fall silent. Colt and the one remaining Venusian were left alone in the bar, them and the unknown men at their feet. "What's your name?" Earthman, the Venusian said. "Colt, you?"
"Sure, and that money belongs to me."
"We can fight over it later," Colt said, "when we get out of this mess." Amusement crinkled Charol's face.
"If we get out, surely," he said.
Colt shrugged. "Any idea what's out there?" he said.
"Rogue, evidently."
"What is Rogue?"
"I don't know."
Charol looked uneasy.
"My money is on something bad."
It was the dying man at their feet. Colt took a close look at him, and was surprised to see it was an Earthman. He was badly scarred and suffering from malnutrition. Burns, oozing pus, covered his hands.
It is treasure.
Treasure? Charol said. He had a purplish mottled skin and small, near-translucent ears close to his skull. They are a more delicate-looking breed on Venus, smaller than Earthmen, and seemingly fragile, but never underestimate them, for it will be the last thing you ever do.
You have my interest, stranger. The temple lies.
The dying man's eyes fluttered closed in a heartbeat. Colt was kneeling, though he kept his eyes and his gun trained on the door. Where, he said, shaking the dying man, roughly. Where?
The rogue,
the stranger said.
The rogue,
with horror and revulsion clear in his voice, and then his breath stilled. Damn you, Colt said. Cheryl's cold chuckle made him glance up. The Venusian was looking at him in amusement.
Death is not the end, Colt of Earth, he said. But let us hope this man's pursuers do not know that.
Let them come, Colt said, and felt the cold, savage fury burn through him, as clean and as pure as a knife. The Venusian merely gestured silently. He and Colt separated, one to each side of the door. Ready?
Is this a gun?
It certainly appears to be one, yes.
Then I'm ready.
They turned together and burst through the doors outside. The sun was low over the horizon behind the clouds. It painted them fantastical shades of violet and red and oozing green. Directly ahead, Colt saw the enemy, just as the enemy saw them. Colt rolled, firing. He preferred a projectile weapon. Beam weapons were fine for dry worlds, for the sterility of space, but on a swamp world, such as Venus, Colt felt better when an honest Earth-made gun, the sort that fired bullets. You knew where you were with bullets. It was almost like being back home. The bullets certainly took the attackers by surprise. Colt did not know what they were. He gleaned impressions as he rolled and fired, tall, ungainly creatures, metal-plated, skinny, two purple antennae, moved sinuously above their heads. He had no doubt they were communicating silently. They moved as one. They were made for war. But so was Colt, who had survived worse odds on a dozen rough and wild planets. To the other side of him, the Venusian Charol was firing steadily, his beam weapon flashing, but it merely glanced off the armor plating of the attacking ant-like creatures. Aim for their antennae, Colt called, and felt rather than saw the Venusian's grin. Charol swept his weapon high, and a terrible hissing sound emanated from the attackers as their fragile communication fronds were seared off. Colt continued to fire, his bullets snapping the attacker's armor. He saw one, two, three drop. Clearly, whatever make or design these things were, they had not been prepared for an Earthman's old-fashioned weapon. But then he saw. Rising behind the ant-like creatures, the source of the explosions that had rocked the bar, a fire burning bright in the sky, dispelling clouds, casting a deathly glow over the swamps and the spaceport itself. Within its glow, Colt could dimly make out a sinuous body, a reptilian head, with large diamond eyes and thin, graceful wings.
What is that?
He said, whispered, and heard Charol's choked reply.
It's a sun-eater.
The attackers parted, and through the open swathe of space, Colt could see the creature soaring high above, a sleek, beautiful being flying on wings of, so it seemed, pure song, and whose exact dimensions it was too difficult to make out, so brightly did it burn. Graceful it might have been, yet it was not free. The ant-like creatures had somehow tethered the sun-eater to ropes of a metallic hue, and like children flying a kite, were controlling it from the ground.
We cannot fight it, Charol said,
and Colt said, "It is beautiful."
"We will die here, Earthman," Sherol said, sounding resigned.
But inside Colt, the coldness of battle was replaced with the heat of rage. Whatever these things were, however much they wanted to kill him, these were the things he understood. Yet to enslave such a creature, such a spirit, was a sin against nature itself. And he could not, would not, allow it. He threw Sherol his gun. The Venusian caught it. "Take care of the advance party," Colt said. "Then follow me."
"What are you going to do?"
"Set it free," Colt said. And with that he was running, the rifle strapped to his back, now in his hands. It was a Martian Corps carbine manufactured for an old war in which Colt had once been a soldier, though it was unclear to this day on which side. He came upon them like a Martian dust devil, a fury as of some lost legend out of Lemuria or Mu, those continents of Earth now lost to the mists of time. The rifle barked, spewing fire. He watched one enemy fall, then another. Blasts of fire singed the air, and a pain crawled over Colt's arm. A burning that made him cry out, but he did not drop the gun. Then he was in their midst, battering, kicking, slamming the butt of the rifle into the strange creature's featureless faces. They were machines, he thought, and memory returned, but he had no time for it, not now. He fired and punched, paying no heed to his own safety, watching only as the thin streaks of silver rope were let drift one by one. Above him, slowly, the Sun-Eater was rising higher into the air. It cried out then, a voice as pure as the water of a glacier. The remaining attackers came at Colt then with renewed fury, and he knew he was done for. They had surrounded him. They had beaten him down to the ground. In the Venusian mud he lay, looking up into a sky illuminated with an artificial sun. "Is this how I die?" he thought. Not bitterly, but with a certain disappointment. He had always seen himself dying, at last, amidst the rolling green hills of Earth. But then, as from afar, he heard the renewed sound of fire, and turning his head so that his cheek rested against the muddy ground, saw the Venusian, Sherol, come running, firing with Colt's own gun. Colt reached out, grabbed one of the ant-thing's legs, and pulled, unbalancing it. He would not die without a fight, he thought, and he set on the metallic creature, prying open its armor with his bare hands, until its plates parted, and inside it a violent green and vociferous purple like congealing blood. The inside of the creature was indeed organic. It was alive. Colt reached for the dagger strapped to his leg, raised it with the last of his power, and plunged it into the ant-thing's gelatinous flesh. A terrible shock ran up his arms from the creature's body as it convulsed and died. Overhead, the Sun-Eater roared, finding its tethers suddenly unmanned. Colt heard the beating of wings and felt the heat of the sun blast down around him. He covered his head with his hands, his fingers slimy with the ant creature's blood, and waited to die. A moment later, still alive, he opened his eyes. All about him was a ring of ash, where an unbearable heat had touched down. The ant things were charred bodies of molten metal and bubbling ichor. Colt raised his eyes to the sky. Above his head, the Sun-Eater hovered, its diamond eyes looking into Colt's. Its wings beat gently, almost lazily, against the air, raising a hot, dry wind. For a long moment, they held each other's gaze. Then, with a final cry in which gratitude or triumph, Colt never knew which, intermingled, the majestic being rose into the sky like the dawning sun.
"Colt! Colt!"
It was Sherol, kneeling beside him, one arm dangling uselessly by his side, White bone jutted out of the flesh.
You're alive.
Colt winced.
Your arm is broken, he said. It's nothing, Sherol said.
He threw Colt his gun back. Colt caught it one-handed. His own arm was badly burned.
Come on.
Where?
Back to the bar before spaceport security or more of these creatures show up.
You want to drink that badly? But Colt was rising, following the Venusian. His rifle was back in its place, his gun back in its holster. He felt good. It felt good to be alive, on Venus or any other world. Wait, he said as they approached the bar. The bodies of ant things littered the ground here, where Colt and Sharol had killed them. He knelt beside one, examined it cautiously.
What are they?
Sharol said.
Replic ants, Colt said.
He turned one arm a foot over, squinting. Imprinted into the metal, as he had expected, was a serial number. The memory returned. He had never seen them until now.
They were manufactured back in the Jovian Wars, he said. The bodies of human conscripts embalmed alive into machine bodies. They were meant for war in space, not on the ground. I had thought that all of them were decommissioned and destroyed years ago.
So how did they come to be here?
Sherol asked, and Colt said, I have no idea.
Come on, Sherol said, losing interest.
He pushed into the dark interior of the bar, and Colt followed. The bottle of archaea miraculously remained undamaged, though it had fallen to the floor. Sherol picked it up, took a long swig, and handed it to Colt. The drink burned pleasantly as it slid down his throat. The corpse of the man who had begun all this lay on the floor.
Rogue, Sherol said thoughtfully.
Treasure, Colt said. They traded glances. Well, Colt said, I guess we'll never know where he came from. Sherol laughed. It was a surprisingly deep sound, and it echoed around the silent room.
I told you, Earthman, he said. Death is not the end. Here, fetch me your knife.
So the Venusian had noticed Colt's concealed dagger. He had proven himself a man of action as good as any Earthman, if not better. He was worthy of grudging respect. And so Colt drew the knife, still slimed, with the replic ant's goo, its blood, and tossed it to the Venusian, who caught it easily with his good hand.
What are you going to...
Colt began, but the Venusian merely grinned cheerfully as he knelt by the dead man. Sherol applied the sharp knife to the dead man's throat and began to saw off the head, whistling cheerfully as he worked. Colt took another swig of archaea. In moments it was over, and Sherol straightened up, tossed Colt back the knife, and picked up the dead man's head by the hair. The face stared sorrowfully at Colt.
Was that really necessary?
Colt said. Sherol paid him no mind.
Let's get out of here, he said.
Where are we going?
We need to find some mud, Sherol said.
Mud?
And we need, Sherol said, and grinned again as he swung the head back and forth with his good hand, to find ourselves a witch.
2. The mud stank. It reeked of fetid water and decomposing plant and animal matter. Colt and Sherol were nestling in the shallow of the swamp. Their clothes lay in an untidy heap on the bank nearby, though Colt kept his gun near. The dead man's head was in a sack drawn with a string. Overhead, the sky was a violent shade of purple, and lightning flashed in the distance, heralding the coming of yet another storm. They were 2 days away from Port Smith, deep into the Venusian jungles. The mud itched where it covered Colt's burns. It was healing them. Sherol beside him was peacefully puffing on a cigar, his arm entirely encased in thick grey mud. Colt's toes stuck out of the water, Beyond them he could see the reeds of the swamp, and here and there the water predators circling unseen. Sometimes a tentacle broke the surface, thick and veined, before dropping into the depths again. "If you don't bother them, they won't bother you," Charol said. His naked chest was scarred with old wounds, much like Colt's. His nipples were small and hard. Colt licked away. When he peeled the mud off, new skin was forming over the burns.
"Remarkable. Venus," Charol said, "has many depths."
Colt eyed the swamp as another tentacle rose to the surface. It was immense, and he did not like the thought of the underwater creature it belonged to.
"I'm sure," he said. "Relax," Charol replied. "Here, give me your back."
Colt turned, and Charol began to apply mud to Colt's skin. The water was as warm as a bath, and Charol's fingers dug deep into Colt's skin, releasing a pressure Colt hadn't even realized was there. He sighed in satisfaction.
"Oh, don't stop," he said.
They remained in the water for some time. When they were done, they washed off the mud and dried themselves on the banks of the swamp. The sun was setting, the sky awash with blood-red hues. In the swamp, a majestic creature was rising to the surface, as large as a ship. Its dome-like head had a beak and enormous red eyes. Around the creature, tentacles rose up to the surface, moving sinuously, creating waves. The beak opened, and a forlorn cry sounded, piercing the night.
"It is the cry of the dwellers," Charol said.
There was a sadness as well as love in his voice.
"Listen,"
Colt did, and became aware of other distant cries rising into the air in answer.
"They are calling to each other, as they do each night across the world, but each year there are fewer and fewer to answer the call."
Colt stared ahead. The creature, this dweller, raised its massive bulbous head toward the unseen stars, crying in a language Colt could not understand. He cleared his throat, embarrassed perhaps at the Venusian's naked display of emotion. "Earth's colonial policy is not my prerogative," he began awkwardly.
"I know, Earthman," Charol said,
and there was bitter mockery in his voice.
"You mean well. You all do, children of Earth, reaching for the stars. So enthusiastic, so sure of yourselves, like overgrown toddlers. You mean us well, and yet you continue to come."
Colt flexed his arm, his new skin tingled. There was a fortune to be made in Venusian mud if it could be exported off-world. There were other places like Port Smith all around the continents of Venus now. New Earth colonies on this once grand world existing on the sufferance of Venus's ancient decaying civilization. One day, the swamps would be drained. Their dwellers processed into dried-up delicacies for the enjoyment of the off-world rich. Their mud packaged and sold in minute quantities for those who could afford its healing properties. He clapped Charol on the back, for those days were not yet, and perhaps, he thought, would never come to be. "Believe me," he said, "I have no desire to stay on this stinking mud ball of a planet any more than I have to. I'm light of funds. I've been shut out and nearly killed, and I don't even know why. And we're carrying a dead man's head in a pouch. Where is this damn witch?" Charol laughed. Overhead, the sky darkened as the unseen sun sank beyond the clouds.
"Oh, Earthman," he said, but not without genuine fondness. "Like a toddler you look, but you do not see."
"See what?" Colt said. Charol wordlessly pointed. Colt squinted. In the dim light, the dweller seemed to grow more immense, rising higher, like a lotus flower opening at night. And then he saw her, a lighter shade against the monster's own, a female figure, nude and lithe, hairless and smooth, her skin the same shade of violet as Cheryl's own. She was perched on the dweller's mantle, and her long, reddish-violet hair caught the rays of dying sunlight through the clouds and momentarily shone. For a moment, Colt forgot to breathe. With a graceful movement, the female Venusian dove, head first, into the water of the swamp. With strong economical strokes, she swam toward them and soon climbed on shore, her body shining with droplets of water like tiny diamonds. He had expected a witch. He had not expected to be bewitched instead. The swamp woman smiled, revealing small, sharp teeth.
"Welcome back, Cheryl," she said. "You bring strange friends."
The Venusian inched his head in reply.
"An empty hat and a dead one," he said, grinning. "This is Colt, the Earthman. Who our companion is, I do not yet know."
"And so you came seeking me?" She turned her attention away from him abruptly, transferring her gaze to Colt's. Her eyes were fever bright. Her scrutiny discomfited Colt.
"I would have come to you earlier," she said, "but I was observing your proclivities in the shallows, and, well, I thought it best to wait."
Colt found himself blushing. Cheryl grinned harder.
"This," he said, "is my sister, Yaro."
"A pleasure," Colt said. "Ma'am?" But again her attention snapped away, this time to the sack in Cheryl's hand.
"A dead man walking who yet did not know it," she said. "Who of us walking around alive under the scarlet skies can ever truly name the time of our demise?"
"We were hoping," Cheryl said, "to find out where he came from."
"Still hunting for treasure, brother?"
"Sure," Cheryl said easily. "Only this time I have a partner."
Again, she cast that quick, mayfly glance at Colt and away. She turned abruptly.
"Come," she said. She led them to a narrow trail away from the swamp into the jungle.
There was nothing for them to do but follow.